From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Mark Herring, the Attorney General of Virginia. But joining us in studio now is Benjamin Cardin. He's a U.S. Senator from Maryland. Senator Cardin, thank you so much for joining us.
Kojo, it's always good to be on your show. Thank you.
If you have questions, comments, praise, or denunciation for the senator, call now. Senator Cardin, the country has been transfixed by the Senate in recent weeks as the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh continues on. The vote was taken today, 51-49 in favor of advancing Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. What do you think of the process so far?
Oh, I think the process has been terrible. The Republican leadership started this off with a calendar that was not realistic. We didn't get all the information we needed before the hearings before the Judiciary Committee, particularly the second hearing in regards to Dr. Ford's allegations. There should have been a full investigation before that hearing, and the list goes on and on. A lot of material was never made available. Just one small example. As a United States Senator, the courtesy is that I get a chance to meet with a nominee for the Supreme Court before the hearings. That was denied to me by the White House before I made my decision. So the process here has not been what it should. I don't think the United States Senate looked good. And, of course, the jury is still out as to what's going to happen with the nominee. The bottom line is this is a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court of the United States. How will Judge Kavanaugh, if he becomes Justice Kavanaugh, rule on your constitutional rights against the powerful? Will he rule for the president over your rights? Will he rule for corporate interest over consumer interest? Will women's health care issues be protected? These are the issues that really have me concerned.
Now, today was the procedural vote to put it up for a vote tomorrow. There were four members of the Senate, Senator Collins, I think from Maine, Jeff Flake, Republican, Joe Manchin, a Democrat, and Lisa Murkowski. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, the Republican, she voted against proceeding with this nomination. With the 51-49 vote today, is it a set deal now that tomorrow would be the same, or could it possibly be that some of these senators who have wavered a great deal maybe won't go along with the final decision to put Judge Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court?
It's certainly not over. We saw on the Affordable Care Act when the late Senator McCain voted no, he had voted to let the issue proceed. So in regards to Senator Flake and Senator Collins and Senator Manchin, I don't believe yet any one of the three have made a pronouncement on their final vote, although I think Senator Flake has indicated an inclination, but I don't think any of the three have announced their final position.
Well, Joe Manchin obviously is in West Virginia, and he's running a tough reelection race. But Jeff Flake is a Republican, not running again. He could make a vote of conscience if he really thought so, and Senator Collins also, and that would change the dynamic right there.
I know Senator Flake well. I think he's going to vote what he thinks is right. I hope that he will vote against the nominee, but he'll do what he thinks is right. Senator Manchin had indicated earlier that he believes there should be an up or down vote, so I don't think today's vote reflects how he may vote tomorrow, and I don't know how he's going to vote tomorrow.
Are you satisfied with the FBI investigation that took place over the course of the past week?
The FBI was restricted in who they could interview. They had a limited list. They did not interview the names that had been suggested by the two individuals who came forward with accusations. So, I'm not satisfied at all. It was time limited. There's more questions that are unanswered than have been answered. This investigation should have been done before the hearing, and Mark Judge should have been a witness in an open hearing so that the members of the Senate and the public could judge his credibility and his knowledge of what happened.
Yeah, Mark Judge was the man who allegedly was in the room with the alleged assault against Dr. Ford. But the politics that's being played out in the Senate is reverberating around the nation, as Kojo just suggested. But in Maryland, do you see any blue wave being enhanced or hurt by in Maryland as we go towards the election. Ben Jealous is running for governor. You've endorsed him as a Democratic nominee. Larry Hogan, the Republican, is very popular. He's avoided the Kavanaugh controversy. He's avoided being tied to Donald Trump. Ben Jealous is behind in polling and money. Where are you seeing that here on the Politics Hour? Where are you seeing that race?
Well, first, I do think there will be a blue wave. I think Democrats are going to do well around the country. I think there's an excellent chance that the House of Representatives will switch. And there is now a greater possibility of the United States Senate than we've seen any time in this election cycle. In Maryland, we're usually considered to be a Democratic state. Governor Hogan's numbers are very positive. We all recognize that. Ben Jealous is running a very energetic campaign. I think he's going to get a great vote out. I really do believe he's competitive in this election. And I looking forward to the last, 31 days of the campaign. I'll be with Ben Jealous tomorrow. Assuming there's no vote on the floor at the time that his rally is scheduled. So we're working together, and I am optimistic. Democrats are going to do very well in Maryland.
One more question on the Judge Kavanaugh hearing. Sexual assault is on many people's minds, and rape crisis lines have been flooded with survivors and their loved ones. On the other hand, we've also heard from people saying that accusations should not be treated as convictions, as some, at least a few fairly public accusations, have been known to be false. What would you say?
I would say everything you just said is totally accurate. But as it relates to Dr. Ford's testimony, she was very credible. She was courageous. They're very serious allegations. And she was entitled to have those matters properly handled by the United States Senate and certainly by the White House. And the way that the investigation was restricted, the way that the time was set up, the way that she did not have the opportunity to have her witnesses before the Senate Judiciary Committee. All that, I think, worked against the Republican leadership properly handling this matter that came forward. That's not to prejudge the issue. The second point, though, listen to Judge Kavanaugh's response. I think we are very troubled with his impartiality and judicial temperament in the way that he responded to Dr. Ford's comments.
Dr. Ford's allegation occurred, the event, she says, occurred in the state of Maryland in Montgomery County. Is there anything that you believe that the police have said they'll make an investigation if they have a formal request, but is there anything that can be done on the state level in Maryland in response to this allegation of misconduct by Judge Kavanaugh?
I think most prosecutors would tell you that an episode like this in high school so many years ago, where you don't have the type of collaborating witnesses that with sharp recollections of specific events, would be a very difficult case to try in the criminal courts. That's not what's really engaged here. We're talking about whether Judge Kavanaugh should be on the Supreme Court of the United States, a lifetime appointment. So, yes, I think the point that, Kojo, you raised about the serious allegations and how we handle that, it's been really difficult. We were getting more and more Me Too and people coming forward just telling us about their personal examples of being abused or sexually assaulted. And we know it happens much more frequently than we want to admit in this country. We know that we historically did not do what's right, and now we really need to take steps to make sure we understand that a lot of people have been traumatized as a result of sexual assaults, and we need to take steps to help.
Our guest is U.S. Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. He is a Democrat. Gentlemen, put on your headphones, please, because Leslie in Salisbury, Maryland, would like to address this issue. Leslie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I am upset because I do not hear any true outrage by our representatives. I have not heard. I hear you sitting there calmly speaking.
Well, let me interrupt and ask you this. Were you impressed by the outrage that Judge Kavanaugh expressed? Would you expect Ben Cardin to express outrage in the same manner?
You know, the GOP is drowning out the Democrats who just sit there calmly and don't speak for the people who are we're flipping out. Our country's being torn apart. We have people, our citizens.
Well, allow me to have Senator Cardin respond. You stand accused of not expressing enough outrage.
Well, I can tell you I am outraged, but I'm going to make sure that I respect the process of a nominee for the Supreme Court of the United States. That's the issue here. Absolutely, I am concerned about the allegations that were made, and I've expressed myself in a pretty forceful way in that regard. I think we can have a debate in this country, and we don't have to scream at each other. So I really do believe that the United States Senate, which is supposed to be the greatest deliberative body in the world, has not performed that way in Judge Kavanaugh's nomination process. I do think we need to raise the issues. Let me tell you what's gotten drowned out. Look, Dr. Ford was very credible, very believable, very courageous. We're talking about a nominee for the Supreme Court of the United States. We're talking about whether Judge Kavanaugh will rule to protect your rights against polluters or your right against corporate America on consumer issues or a woman's right of choice. There's a lot of very important issues at stake here. So I don't want to drown out the consequences of a Justice Kavanaugh. I want to make sure we have that debate so that the people of this country understand what's at stake with Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation process. I am concerned about his impartiality and his judicial temperament as the way he expressed himself in response to Dr. Ford.
And you, and the senator, obviously you don't want the Senate floor to become a cable show, but the senators are in fact politically outnumbered, and the Republicans, and we've said it on the show before, want to move and get Judge Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court and make a generational change in the Supreme Court. Even some have said at the risk of suffering badly at the polls in November. President Trump, clearly, who was staying out of it for a short time, is back on the campaign trail saying, making fun, some people say, of Dr. Ford. And it seems to coarsening more of the politics.
And elections have consequences. Please understand that. The fact that the president of the United States is Donald Trump has obviously made a big difference in America. The fact that the United States Senate's controlled by the Republicans makes a big difference. Unless we have two Republicans who join us, we cannot stop anything that Mitch McConnell wants to do in scheduling the vote on Judge Kavanaugh. That's the facts. So we have to understand elections have consequences. We also have to understand that President Trump has the biggest platform of all, and he changes the storyline several times a day, and the news shows will cover him. I've spoken, I don't know how many times, dozens of times on Judge Kavanaugh. I don't quite get the same press attention as the president gets on this issue.
I see you on the CNN several times. I think it's CNN several times. Yeah. You're almost a paid contributor there. But this person who called, she was obviously heard her tone of voice. What would be your advice? Obviously, the advice would be go vote and to get your friends to vote, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of ways to get involved. I mean, I do think that there's been a lot of activity around this nomination, and I think it's having an impact. The people who've called to relate their own personal stories, or the people who have called with concern about the cases before the Supreme Court, it makes a difference. But clearly, the midterm elections are going to be very important in this country.
Speaking of elections, you're facing a few challengers, including Republican Tony Campbell and Independent Neil Simon. This after your primary race got some national attention after whistleblower and activist Chelsea Manning entered the race. Have any of these opponents affected how you are running your race, and do the challenges you face from both the right and left show you anything about your constituency that changes how you plan to govern if elected or re-elected in November?
Well, Kojo, thank you for the question. I run my campaign presenting my record, what I've done, to the voters of Maryland. I planned that election. I know that running for the Senate is going to attract a lot of interest, but I look forward to the campaign. I want the voters to understand my passion and what I've done to help the people of Maryland. I'm going to put forward my record. These are extremely challenging circumstances, and yet this year I got major things done for the people of Maryland, including the Chesapeake Bay Program funding, which the president had cut out of the budget. We got that done, including an infrastructure bill for water that's going to give us more money for our aging pipes for clean water against the threat of lead and help the Chesapeake Bay, including just this past week, the opioid legislation. I met with leaders around the state. They asked me for more flexibility on the use of federal funds. My amendments were included in the opioid package to allow the local governments to use creative new treatment centers rather than having to follow one model. So my answer to you is I'm going to present what I've done for the people of Maryland. My job is to do what I can to help the citizens of Maryland. I've done that, and I've stood up where President Trump has been wrong in regards to the values of America, his immigration policy of separating families. I'm going to talk about that, or where he gave oxygen for hate and what he did in Charlottesville. These are going to be issues that I'm going to talk about. So as you can see, I enjoy campaigning. I'm looking forward to
Well, I think we're getting issues. A little more of the emotion that the previous caller wanted. But I must point out for the folks who don't know either the Republican nominee or the independent who's running, on Sunday at 3 o'clock, there is a televised forum that WJLA, alternate station, used to be called News Channel 8, now it's WJLA 24/7 at 3 o'clock on Sunday. I don't know how that's going to compete with football, but in any event, you can see you and your opponents. And I want to point out today is the senator's birthday.
Well, I know how to celebrate a birthday with you guys. I appreciate it very much.
Well, happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you.
75, right?
It's one of those milestones.
That's
absolutely
right.
You mentioned the opioid legislation, and we all know how severe the opioid crisis is in Maryland. But what would this package of legislation do for Maryland if President Trump signs it, as he's expected to do?
So let me give you a couple examples. We have a couple jurisdictions who want to set up what are known as stabilization centers to get those that are OD'd out of the emergency room to a facility where they can get the care they need to deal with their addiction and not be disruptive in the emergency rooms for other people who need care in that setting. The legislation that we passed reauthorizes the Cures Act and provides additional funding also through SAMHSA, which is an agency that provides help. They can use those types of funds for that type of initiative. We also have a lot of peer support programs in Maryland. These are programs where you use people who have addiction issues, who help those who are suffering from addiction, that we're looking at more flexible funding through Medicaid to reimburse for those types of programs. Both of those issues I initiated on in the committee that were included in the final package. We also are protecting first responders. We have, as you know, fentanyl that gets used with either heroin or opioids, which is deadly. And we're finding a lot of people dying before we can get them resuscitated because of the use of this synthetic drug. This bill takes direct action to stop fentanyl from getting into America and protecting our first responders so that they're not affected when they come to a scene in regards to fentanyl. And the list goes on. There's a lot of good things in this bill, and several of which are initiatives that I've brought forward to the committees.
Here now is Cotter in Greenbelt, Maryland. Cotter, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. That's Cotter, like the old show. Welcome back if people are old enough. Senator Cardin, Senator Cardin, I met you at the Greenbelt Labor Day parade and at the Old Line. I don't know if you remember that, but I want to let the listeners know, first of all, I'm a lefty, so I support Ben Jealous and I support Ben Cardin. I like what you're doing. But I called Governor Hogan's office on yesterday, I believe it was, and I asked him to follow the lead of Ben Jellison condemning the disgraceful display that Donald Trump showed at his campaign rally, mocking Dr. Blasey Ford.
What was the response you got from Governor Hogan's office?
And the response that he gave me was that's a national matter and that he needs to focus on issues that are concerning Marylanders. And I've heard that response from his office before, especially concerning the travel ban.
You give Senator Cardin the opportunity to weigh in on Governor Hogan and his relationship or lack thereof with President Trump.
Well, first let me point out what President Trump did at that campaign rally. This is a political campaign rally. And he's talking about a Supreme Court nominee, which we should be trying to elevate outside the political arena, and then mocks a person who's come forward with serious allegations, credible allegations, about sexual assault. It was outrageous. I think all of us should condemn that, whether we're the governor of Maryland, the United States Senator, or a private citizen.
Well, in this case, I want to ask one thing we haven't mentioned is the Trump is the real world for many thousands of people who live in Maryland and Virginia is the federal pay raise. The President Trump was saying that he did not want to do the federal pay raise that sent shockwaves to Barbara Comstock over in the 10th District in Virginia. Where does that stand now? Will the federal workers be getting this 1.9% pay raise?
I believe there was some action in the courts within the last 24 hours that said that were positive that they would get the raise. We have worked, Democrats and Republicans in Congress, to counter a lot of what Donald Trump has done. You know, one of my jobs is to get things done in the political environment. So I work with Republicans in trying to get things accomplished. The budget that we pass includes money for the raise. So we are optimistic that that raise will go forward. It's the Congress who makes these policies, not the President of the United States. He carries out the policy that Congress comes forward with. And we were very fortunate in this budget process to get a good budget, not only for our federal workforce, but for our federal agencies to have the resources they need, whether it's NIH or whether it's FDA or whether it's NIST. They all got realistic budgets to carry out their work. And I was proud that our Maryland federal delegation worked hard to make sure that happened. The federal workforce deserves this raise, and we're going to fight hard to make sure they get it.
But in addition,
it's a cost of living adjustment. It's not really a raise.
I was about to say the cost of living adjustment, because when they were told they wouldn't receive it, you called that move retribution for a recent court ruling that did away with many presidential executive orders that affected workers. Can you explain that?
Certainly. The president issued several executive orders that made it very difficult for federal workers to organize, to be able to have collective bargaining, to do several things that backed off some of their benefits. He did it through executive order. It was challenged in the courts. It was also challenged, I must tell you, by many of us in Congress. And the courts held back and said, no, the president can't do everything that he did. So our point was, because the president couldn't dictate this through executive order because he didn't have the power, he was now trying to take it out on our federal workforce by denying them their cost of living. Outrageous. We all came to expressed ourselves on it, and we are hopeful that that cost of living adjustment will go forward.
Is there a federal role? Kojo and I were on Monday night. We're at Montgomery Cable, and we did a forum with the Montgomery County executive candidates. And, of course, my driving out there from Southwest Washington made transportation the number one issue for me. But it truly is a major issue in the suburban Washington area, particularly Montgomery County, I-270, 495. Is there a Senate federal role here in trying to make changes, even if you improve the lanes? Mark Elwood, your Democratic nominee, and Nancy Florin, both the independent who's running, both have said, well, we can fix the highways maybe with more lanes or changing the use of the lanes, but there's still backups on Georgia Avenue and Connecticut Avenue and 355. It's a victim. Montgomery, they all want Montgomery County to grow more, and people are saying, where the heck are we going to put people?
Well, I think there is a role for the federal government. Clearly, the primary planning role is that going to be at the state and local government. They're the ones who are going to plan what they need as far as mass transit and as far as roads are concerned. We know that we're moving ahead on the Purple Line. It's not exactly as it was originally planned, but that's going to be a very important. With the federal funding is there for the Purple Line, so we've made our commitment. We could have had expansion of mass transit in Baltimore through the Red Line. The funding was there for it. Governor Hogan canceled that project. I think that was a mistake. We do have planning for additional transportation needs in Montgomery County and this region. I agree with you. If I'm leaving Capitol Hill and trying to get to a meeting in Rockville, it is a struggle at any time, but certainly during rush hour. So,
and the federal government doesn't do more maybe to help Metro. There's a new report out this week that Metro needs to increase the number of cars to have peak fare all day. They need to change the bus system. But it cannot be done without either getting more money from the local jurisdictions and or the feds. The feds are paying a minuscule part of the cost, but none of the operating costs.
Well, Metro is the nation's rail system. It's the number of people who use it to work for the federal government, the largest single user is the workforce for the federal government. It's critically important role for the federal government to play. We have it's an unusually funded system without a dedicated revenue source. The federal government has provided
1.5 billion over a 10-year period. We have one more year left on that. Our delegation is committed to making sure that we continue that federal government commitment. We'd like to see
money only for the capital construction budget. That's not for the operating budget.
It's somewhat fungible, right. But I would accept the fact that they have significant needs well beyond the current funding sources. And as you know, the local jurisdictions are all looking at putting some additional funds. Right. It's an old system. It really needs attention. It's operating at capacity. And the population is growing. We need to expand its capacity. It's not just expanding additional routes. It's expanding the current routes we have right now in order to take care of the demand for this. You just see the people coming in 270 from as far out as Washington County to get in on our metro system. You're right.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to the partisan gerrymandering of Maryland's 6th House of Representative District in Western Maryland, which former Governor Democrat Martin O'Malley admits were redrawn in 2011 to benefit Democrats. This week, a panel of federal judges raised the idea of having an independent, nonpartisan commission redraw those district lines. How do you think the state should move forward on this?
I think the redistricting process is absolutely wrong. It needs to change in this country. I know that Congressman Sarbanes has joined legislation in the House because I think it really needs to originate in the House because we're talking about House lines. You can't change the Senate lines, so I don't get involved personally on redistricting. We should have a national effort to set up a much more nonpartisan way to draw these congressional lines. Let me just remind you, I'm not late to this game. I testified in Annapolis on one of the redistricting maps that affected me against the map. I think it's wrong the way we draw the lines, and I think it's one of the fundamental problems that we have in the House of Representatives on the partisanship that you see displayed, because most of the members don't even have general elections. Their election is strictly a primary.
Virginia is having the same issue with its state House delegates, about a dozen of them in the middle of the state. But you're the former Speaker of the House in the Maryland General Assembly. Were you there for a redistricting? Such a long career, it's hard to get it all in my mind.
Yes, I was. There's several of the redistricting maps I was involved in directly drawing.
2000?
But there, none of the districts look like they look today. I never put the Anne Arundel County into so many districts that they're in today, and having lines that go from the western border all the way into Montgomery County, and to see the third district.
The first district in Maryland is an odd shape also. It's the whole eastern part of the
state. Right. So, look, it's a political process. It's going to be hard to remove politics completely from it, but there's a better way to do it than we're doing it today. And I understand the reluctancy of one state to change because why should Democrats give up an advantage in Maryland if the Republicans in 30 states aren't doing the same? I get that. I really do. But the current system needs to change, and you need leadership to bring about that change, and we need leadership from the state.
Almost out of time, but Lawrence emails, should the Senate, the U.S. Senate, go back to requiring a 60-vote majority for Supreme Court appointments? That would seem to encourage presidents to nominate centrists, no? Or is there no possibility that would ever happen?
I think we should go back to the 60-vote threshold on the Supreme Court nominees. It is not going to be, it was never used, by the way. It was always caused what you just said, Kojo, and that is presidents were much more engaged with members of the Senate on both sides of the aisle and presented candidates that could get that 60-vote threshold on process. Let me remind you, there were several cases where the Senate voted to move forward with a nominee, even though it takes 60 votes, and then the nominee didn't get 60 votes on final passage. But we at least had that comedy that is lacking right now because of the lack of the 60-vote threshold. To me, the return of the 60-vote threshold would bring us back to the type of responsible leadership and working together on a nominee such as the Supreme Court of the United States, that is how the Senate should operate. So I strongly support going back to that 60-vote threshold.
Can we ask you, how are you going to celebrate your birthday other than that historic vote today and one tomorrow?
Well, you know, we have a tradition in our family.
I don't think he considers those celebrations, but go ahead.
Well, thank you for that question. We have on Friday nights, we have a traditional Friday night dinner. and most of my family will be there. I have a couple, I have a niece who celebrates her birthday right around mine, so I'm going to celebrate it with family tonight. And my daughter is going to come all, my granddaughter is going to come all the way home from College Park tomorrow so I can have dinner with her all my grandchildren. So it's going to be, it's a good weekend to celebrate.
Leave the address for tonight. Tom and I love to gate crash these celebrations. U.S. Senator Ben Cardin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the Attorney General of Virginia, Mark Herring. If you have questions or comments for him, you can start calling now. Tom Sherwood, the D.C. Council hit two hot-button issues this week. Let's talk about first the repeal of Initiative 77, which the voters approved, but which have raised the tipped minimum wage for tipped workers to $15 an hour by the year 2025. That was repealed by the council. Why?
Well, the council members, they were heavily lobbied by, I have to always say this. My son is in the bar business, and so I have to, I don't want to recuse myself from this conversation, but I'd like to acknowledge he's in the bar business and in the city of Washington. The minimum wage initiative would have raised all the wages up to $15 over that period of time, and the restaurant industry and other industries said that would be devastating to the entertainment industry, restaurant industry in the city, and most of the council members agreed with them. Alyssa Silverman tried to work out a compromise that would extend the time that these changes would be made so that there could be more adjustment by the restaurant industry, but it failed on an 8-5 vote. And so the council members went ahead and repealed this Initiative 77, which would have gone into effect next week. There will be some possibly other changes. They did add some sweeteners on sexual harassment within the restaurant industry, the tip worker industry, and wage theft protections. One of the issues in this whole law, and I don't want to keep going on this, is that many of the restaurants, many of the businesses that pay these employees smaller amounts of money never fully compensate them. So that's a big issue, wage theft, and that will be addressed maybe more seriously, even though this initiative itself didn't go forward.
Joining us in studio right now is Mark Herring. He's the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us, General Herring.
Coach, thank you so much for having me.
It's not your birthday, is it?
Not today, okay. No. But thank you for having me, and it's great to be back on the show. And Tom, good to see you again.
I want to talk about Airbnb regulations in Virginia. But first, in D.C., Tom, the other thing the council did was voted to restrict Airbnb and similar rentals in the nation's capital, basically saying that if you are not a resident in your home that is being used as an Airbnb, then you're going to be limited for how much you can rent that second property that you happen to own for Airbnb. And a lot of people, 90 days, a lot of people don't like it.
Well, a lot of people do. If you live in a neighborhood where a house next door to you has become a party house on the weekends for people who come in from out of town, cheap rent for $100, get somebody's house and then trash it, and you live in that neighborhood, that's not a good thing. But this has been, this is, you're seeing this across the country, Miami Beach, New York City, other Chicago, other places where the tourism industry is a big deal and people are coming in and buying houses or using houses. Some people were taking vacant homes and renting them out on short term. And Kenyon McDuffie, one of the first sponsors of this bill, said, look, these houses are, and apartments are places where people could live. We have a housing shortage in this city. So the council decided that they would put some restrictions on it. Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member, tried to move up your ability to rent out your house from 90 days to 120, but they kept it at 90. And that's a lot of days out of the year for you to rent your house out. But you have to be an occupant of the home. You have to be there. It can't be a second home.
Is it up to local jurisdictions in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
You know, there has been in Virginia some state legislative efforts, but mostly the emphasis has been on localities and letting localities to, you know, give them the autonomy to wrestle through some of those land use issues, some of those local tax issues. And this is really all part also of a larger issue about this rapid pace of technology change and new forms of business models that are continually being developed. And I would say for Virginia, we want to make sure we get technology right. We want to make sure that we protect people's privacy. We want to protect communities, but we also want to make sure that we do it in a way that continues to foster innovation and supports consumer choices.
It's hard getting ahead of the technology curve, isn't it?
It is. And as Attorney General,
the very subject, the Attorney General was part of a group of attorneys general who sued Uber for its failure to disclose its information. I don't want to get too technical in it, but the state got several million dollars from Uber because it didn't disclose what? That it's the extent of its business? And
It was more about the extent of data breach. And there are important requirements that companies have to notify attorneys general when there is a data breach as soon as possible. And because of that delay, then it subjected them to some penalties. And so this is something that as attorney general, it's one of the aspects of this rapid change and the impact on the law and attorneys general are right there in the forefront because there are a host of legal issues that arise as these new business models, these new platforms are developed and come out and meet new consumer demands.
And just on Uber, there's a new study out that says that most of the Uber drivers are making less than $10 an hour after they figure in all the expenses. And it just seems to me it's a whole consumer issue and customer issue.
It's a consumer and customer issue, but it's also a workforce issue. Mm-hmm. And I know this is an area that Senator Warner has worked a lot on in this gig economy where you go from one job to another. How do we make sure that those traditional benefits, whether it's health care or retirement, are in place for workers in the new economy that we're in?
We just talked with Senator Cardin about the opioid legislation the Senate passed earlier this week. You are suing Purdue Pharma for its alleged role in creating and in prolonging the opioid crisis in Virginia. At issue is their marketing and sales programs. How exactly are you alleging that Purdue Pharma broke the law?
Well, first, let me just say I heard a little bit of that last segment, and I think that legislation is going to be really helpful in providing a lot of needed funding for prevention and education, as well as treatment and recovery. This is something I've been working on almost since the first day I became Attorney General 4.5 years ago. And what I've done is approached it in a really comprehensive way, recognizing that this is as much a health crisis as it is a law enforcement issue. And so I focused on education and prevention and treatment alongside of enforcement. And a part of that is also holding those who we believe who are responsible for creating or prolonging this crisis accountable. And I've been a part of a large-scale, multi-state investigation with other attorneys general into the marketing practices and business practices of pharmaceutical companies and distributors. That work is ongoing.
Can you tell us where that is? I mean, us ordinary citizens get lost in the legal process. Yeah. Where does that stand at this moment?
Well, that work is ongoing. These cases are incredibly complex and document intensive, so it's in the process of where we are continuing to gather documents and analyze them. And in the case of Purdue Pharma, I felt that we had gotten far enough along in the investigation that it was time to go ahead and bring suit against Purdue Pharma for what we allege is their part in continuing or creating this crisis. We believe that they have violated the Consumer Protection Act and also have created a public nuisance. And so we filed suit in Tazewell County, which is in Southwest Virginia. Southwest Virginia has been especially hard hit by the opioid crisis, in particular pills, and we know that this is a crisis that has, it is as much created in the medicine cabinet as out on the streets. And so what we've done is we've recently unsealed a redacted copy that we filed initially. Once we were able to unseal all of it, what it showed is that there were 2.2 million prescriptions over a 10-year period in Virginia, 150 million pills and patches. There were years where that's more than twice the pills than the population. There were some localities where that number was even higher. And I'm tired of the laws, of the lies, of the misrepresentations. And so I decided to sue Purdue Pharma. I want the lies to stop. I want those who are responsible to be held accountable. And at an appropriate time, we'll be asking for compensation and fines and penalties.
These are civil cases. Some people have suggested that Purdue Pharma or similar people ought to have criminal charges. Is there any suggestion on your part that there ought to be maybe criminal charges that sometimes follow civil cases?
Well,
it's too early to say.
Yeah, this action doesn't preclude that, and we felt comfortable moving forward in a civil nature. But we're going to continue our work on the investigation. And just because we only filed against Purdue Pharma doesn't mean that there won't be other cases in the future. We just felt that there was
enough. It is the principal company.
They were one of the largest ones. And they have built an empire and amassed a fortune based on suffering and lies. This has touched the lives of families all across Virginia and across this country. And so we're going to continue to hold those who we feel are responsible to account, while at the same time pursuing a really comprehensive strategy of prevention and education, and holding those who divert drugs, the prescribers, if they illegally put them out on the street. We do probably an average of one or two of those a week.
Our guest is Mark Herring. He is the Attorney General of Virginia. We're taking your calls if you have questions or comments for him.
Well, let's get to some hot politics right now. Before you became Attorney General, you were from Loudoun County and in the state Senate. And Jennifer Wexton is the person who took that seat, won that seat after you gave it up. She's in the battle to defeat, the congressional battle to defeat Barbara Comstock, polling the show, and she's ahead. It's your home county, Loudoun County, principally. What is your assessment of that race? I know you're the Democrat supporting Jennifer Wexton, but put on your analyst hat.
You know, I think Jennifer is a great candidate, a really good fit for the district. And as you mentioned, I represented the 33rd Senate District, which was is composed of Eastern Loudoun and Western Fairfax. That's really the heart of the 10th District. It stretches out to Clark County and Winchester and Frederick County, as well as parts of Fairfax. And I think Jennifer is a really good fit for the district. I've known her for years. She was a former assistant Commonwealth's attorney and prosecuted criminals for domestic and sexual violence. I've also practiced law in Leesburg, as she did, so we knew each other in that capacity. And I could not have asked for a better partner when she was elected to the Senate. She worked on things like expanding Medicaid. She was a strong supporter of public education, and she will perform that role also as Congresswoman of standing up to Donald Trump and the worst excesses and impulses of the administration.
That was the easy question I asked, the hard one.
Okay.
When you ran for Attorney General first before your reelection last year, you were, Justin Fairfax, a little-known lawyer in the state, ran against you and came pretty close to winning that race in the primary, and then he went on to win the lieutenant governor's race last year. Now you didn't run for governor. You thought about running for governor. You decided not to when Ralph Northam did, because you guys were fairly close in the Senate. You let him go forward. I know you'd like to be governor. Where are you and Justin Fairfax now, the lieutenant governor, who's from Fairfax, in terms of setting up the tables for 2021? And that's not as far away as it sounds.
Well, I ran for re-election last year because I love the job that I'm doing right now. I believe that I've really shown Virginians just what an attorney general can do for them. And we're standing up to the Trump administration's policies when they violate the Constitution and the law, and Virginians are hurt. So we won't hesitate to continue to do that work. And that's what I'm really focused on right now. I'm sure there will come a time when I will need to take a look at that and make a decision. I've really enjoyed campaigning with Justin this time and crisscrossing the state and sharing the ticket with him.
But you recognize he potentially could be an opponent for a governor in 2021.
That could potentially be, but you know, I'm going to stay focused on the job I'm doing right now, and when that time comes, I'll think about how I can best serve Virginians.
Give us a call, Justin. Tell us what your plans are. Virginia lawmakers are trying to redraw House of Delegates districts to rectify what the U.S. District Court ruled on constitutional racial gerrymandering. This week, Republicans presented Governor Northam with what they call a politically neutral and race-blind map, but Governor Northam said that he would veto it. How do you think the Commonwealth should go about redrawing these district lines?
Well, first of all, the idea that legislators can sit around and pick their own voters is ridiculous, and it's wrong, and I've been fighting for some kind of nonpartisan method to do the redistricting and take it out of the hands of the politicians. We don't have that system right now, and so what we've got is a situation where a three-judge panel and a very thorough, long, 93-page opinion found overwhelming evidence that the House of Delegate districts sorted voters into districts based on the color of their skin. And that is something that should be, that is a grave concern for me. It should be for all Virginians and everyone. I am going to continue to hold out hope and be optimistic that the legislature will be able to agree on a map that the governor can sign that is fair, that is constitutional and legal. At this point, it looks like that may not happen by October 30th, which is the deadline that the court has given the General Assembly to come up with a map. And so what I'm doing is I will be working in court as hard as I possibly can to make sure the court is able to read, assuming the General Assembly is unable to get to a map that is agreeable and legal and fair, then I'm going to be asking the court to move as quickly as possible to draw maps that are fair and legal and get them in place in time for the 2019 elections. We should not have racially gerrymandered districts one day longer in Virginia, nor should we be wasting more money trying to fight them.
The Republican House Speaker Kurt Cox has suggested that the governor and you don't really want the assembly to go forward with this, that you want the court to redraw the lines. And they say they're going to have yet, I think October 21st, they're going to have yet again called a session into order to pass something. But they're worried that the governor might veto it and play hardball on this.
Well, again, I'm going to continue to be optimistic and hopeful that the politicians and the General Assembly, the legislators, will be able to reach an agreement, come up with a fair map. The governor had, in a letter, expressed his disappointment that it appears that it continues to be a highly partisan process. And, you know, as that kind of continues to point to why this needs to be taken out of the hands of politicians and given into some kind of nonpartisan commission. There are other states that have come up with some models to look at. Iowa has had one for a number of years. Arizona was able to get one passed through referendum. Now, we don't have referendum and initiative in Virginia, but I sense concerns are reaching voters, and voters are going to begin to demand their representatives to come up with some kind of process to fix this.
The Lee County School Board is appealing your rejection of its request to arm teachers. Your office said their plan violated state law, while the board says it's a step toward protecting students, teachers, and staff from school shootings. Do you think any compromise is possible here?
Well, first of all, our students should be able to learn in an environment that is safe and secure, but putting guns and arming untrained and unqualified personnel into schools is completely incompatible with that. It's also inconsistent with state law. I issued the opinion a few weeks ago. Based on that, the Department of Criminal Justice Services denied Lee County's application. They've indicated they'll appeal. Since then, I've also learned that Lee County was awarded about $150,000 from the Department of Criminal Justice Services for a school resource officer, and other security measures. So I think that's a step in the right direction. And I think that's what we should be doing, is sitting around the table with bringing everybody who has a stake in this. And, you know, we all have a stake in safe schools, but teachers, parents, law enforcement, administrators, and identify, okay, what are the legal ways? And the General Assembly has considered legislation 5 years in a row that would allow teachers to be armed and rejected it for good reason. It increases the risk.
Well, generally, teachers have not wanted it across the board, not just teacher unions, but teacher groups.
Yeah. The overwhelming percentage of teachers are opposed to it, and for good reason, because it increases the risk of a tragic accident or a horrific mistake during an emergency. And what I would like to see us do, rather than try to find some workaround that conflicts with state law, let's sit around the table, identify the ways the General Assembly has provided for school safety and work within those.
Just very quickly, Lee County, we mentioned that as if everyone knows where Lee County is. It's about as far west as you can get in the far corner of Virginia, isn't it? That the corner down there near Kentucky,
it's the farthest,
and Tennessee?
Farthest west, yeah.
All right, just so you'll know, you're nowhere near Northern Virginia.
You're right. We're running out of time very quickly. But this week, four people were arrested for their alleged roles in the Unite the Right rally in 2017. They're Californians from a white supremacist group called the Rise Above Movement. What do you know about them? And beyond the violence in 27, do they have any presence in this region?
You know, what I know is that people came from all over the country and descended on Charlottesville last year. And that does not reflect the hatred that we saw does not reflect who we are as Virginians. And I have seen a rise in hate crimes across Virginia. We've seen it across the country. The number of hate groups that have been identified is staggering, which is why I've asked the General Assembly for additional tools to combat hate crimes. And we've got to take this rise in white supremacist violence seriously. We've seen even in Northern Virginia, on Martin Luther King Day, the KKK was flyering neighborhoods trying to recruit members. And it has not helped when we have a president who seems to equate the white supremacists with those people who have come to express a view that we need to be able to treat people equally and fairly, and that's who we are. So this rise in white supremacist violence is something I'm deeply concerned about, and I've come up with some ideas about how to combat it in the legislature, and I'm going to continue to work to try to get those.
40 seconds.
Corey Stewart, the Republican candidate against Tim Kaine, the Democratic senator, has not been as aggressive in rejecting some of these Confederate issues and white supremacist stuff. He's done some, but not much. Where is that race in your mind?
I know
you're a Democrat.
Yeah, and I think Senator Kaine has done a great job for Virginia and for our country. We've got America's dad against the Confederacy's last holdout with Corey Stewart. And, you know, he is a part of that movement that's trying to stoke those fears of division and hatred. And I think Virginia voters aren't going to have any of it. And they're going to support Senator Kaine, who has done a great job for us.
Mark Herring is the Attorney General of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be back.
That's it for today's show. Subscribe to our Politics Hour Only podcast wherever you get your podcasts because, hey, Election Day is coming up and you don't want to be out of the loop. Speaking of which, coming up Monday, we'll discuss Get Out the Vote efforts targeted at young adults. What actually works? What effect will the youth vote have in November? Plus, we'll get an update on the dramatic changes at Providence Hospital. That all starts Monday at noon. Between now and then, Tom Sherwood, what will you be doing?
Something that'll be supportive of the nation. I don't know what yet.
We will be bidding a fond farewell to our beloved engineer, Goodwill Bunting, Meg Bunting, moving on to other things. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Ingalisa Strobstorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Lauren Marco. Our engineer is Meg Bunting.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nandi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.